Hello, it is June 2nd, 2013, and this is episode 20 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. As is always the case, the thoughts and opinions and stories I cover on this reflect my opinions and don't represent those of my employer. Well, first off, I hope everyone had a good week. I spent some time down in Florida with my family and had a very relaxing week. It was definitely good to get away for a while, and I'll have to say I was pretty unplugged, so I'm fairly far behind in news. All right, so let's go ahead and get started. First up, there's some reports going around about the U.S. power grid in particular and utilities more generally being vulnerable to cyber attacks. As is often the case, it's kind of hard to tell what the motivation behind this story really is. We're seeing a lot of quotes from different members of Congress and the government at large, quoting fairly alarming numbers, like one particular company, which I don't think is named, citing that they have 10,000 attacks a month, and another is quoted as saying they are probed multiple times per day looking for vulnerabilities. I have to tell you, without any additional context, I think the average company can relate to both of those statements. Clearly, depending on how you define an attack, in quotes, some organizations probably see 10,000 attacks in a day, and everybody that's on the internet is being probed for vulnerabilities. So unless there's more context here than meets the eye, which I suppose is possible, this seems like just part of being on the internet and not necessarily alarming unto itself. But I think the subtext is that when you pair this with the knowledge that our infrastructure is apparently grossly vulnerable to attack, we have a recipe for disaster that requires some kind of new government regulation. One of the fears stated in the article is that attackers might be able to actually physically damage the grid infrastructure and, in particular, target some transformers basically by overloading them. And those transformers, depending on their position in the grid, they can be pretty large and have a very long lead time to replace. And while there are some equipment sharing cooperatives to cover disaster type situations, there really aren't enough of those to go around if there were a really widespread, quote, attack. So the proposal, of course, is more government regulation, which, hey, that may be the thing that's needed. The question becomes, in what form does it appear, and is it going to be effective or not? If we can't keep design documentation of really highly secret military systems out of the hands of the Chinese, I do question our ability to apply effective regulations against a very disparate set of companies across the country. And don't misunderstand, I'm not slamming people. This is a really, really difficult job. And when you're talking about sophisticated foreign government type adversaries, there's often not a lot you can do because there are so many different ways that systems and data can be attacked. Well, the next story is a related one in the New York Times, and it quotes some American officials and corporate security experts as stating that Iran is actively attacking U.S. companies, particularly oil, gas, and electricity companies. And they go on to say this is kind of a tit-for-tat from the Stuxnet attack that happened a couple years ago. And it seems the particular concern would be a Saudi Aramco type of attack scenario where they used the Shamoon virus to wipe out tens of thousands of systems. And probably even more likely to mirror what was done in South Korea a couple of months back. But that's just my speculation. So, to me, these are very interesting stories from a high-level security and risk management perspective. If you are running an entity or you're in charge of security for an entity who, in particular, has really key infrastructure and something akin to a hospital or a electric grid or something like that, you really need to have a very solid and robust risk management view on things and take a close look at how you're architected and where are you vulnerable. What are the worst case scenarios if, for instance, some very sophisticated attacker were to come after you? And that could be somebody coming in via the internet. It could be somebody plugging in a USB key. It could be a rogue employee. Now, they have different levels of likelihood and certainly different levels of impact. And ultimately, they are business decisions, but at the end of the day, there is some moral obligation on the part of these critical infrastructure providers to do what's necessary, or at least have solid contingency plans for those things that can't readily be mitigated. But again, you know, to me, this seems fairly basic. I think we're starting to see, and maybe I'm just behind the times here, but I think we're really starting to see that there is a lot of peril in internet connecting a lot of these key systems. It certainly does make things very efficient and does have an ability to lower costs, but at the same time, it really exposes us to fairly simple attacks by many, many, many different adversaries from all over the world. And this is something that we really haven't had to deal with before. And, you know, maybe the people who are operating the important valves or the important switchgear shouldn't be allowed to access Facebook or Twitter from the systems they use to perform those sensitive functions. But that's just me. All right, moving on. Next up is a story from InfoSecurity Magazine about the shift of APT-style attacks to going after keys and certificates. And there were some interesting quotes in here about Symantec having identified over 800 different pieces of malware designed to steal keys and certificates in just 1 month. And the point of the article is that, you know, well, I guess the point of the article is to get people to sign up for a Ponemon webinar, which, you know, hey, it's a Ponemon webinar. What can I say? But the point of it is that we haven't been doing as much to protect keys and certificates as we probably ought to. And now we're seeing some of those things come back around and be used in some new attacks. So we're seeing a lot of malware now being signed with certificates that have been stolen. You know, we're starting to see attacks using SSH keys. People are starting to realize that while they may have deactivated or changed passwords after former employees leave, the SSH keys live on, and former employees potentially still have access to systems using those old keys. And so collectively, we really need to start incorporating better key management into our normal operations, the same way we've done with patches and ID management. And I'm not saying that we've nailed those, but that these really have not generally been factored in. I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think as time goes on and we as an industry continue to move in a direction where certificate-based trust schemes are more and more incorporated into our infrastructure, this is going to be a significant avenue of attack against our infrastructures. Okay, next story, the FSB, no, not that FSB, the Federation of Small Businesses in the UK, put out a press release, and there was one really interesting quote in here that basically said 36% of businesses admit to regularly patching their systems, and 60% say they regularly update their antivirus. Obviously, that's pretty bad. Small businesses don't often have all the resources they need to fully patch and do all the things that are needed to do to maintain their IT infrastructure. But at the same time, having an IT infrastructure is kind of like having a kid. You really can't ignore it, because if you do, it's just going to come around and bite you in the butt later. So benefiting from the automation and productivity improvements you get from computerizing different job functions, you really have to be smart about how you offset and invest in keeping things up to date. It's kind of table stakes now. I think for a long time, these smaller businesses could kind of skate by because there really weren't people out to get them. But now we're all connected, and so many of the attacks are automated now. The attackers really don't care how big your business is or what kind of business you're in. The fact is they can get in and figure out how to steal your intellectual property, steal your money, and so on. The good news is that most of the smaller businesses don't tend to have very complicated infrastructures and specialized pieces of software, and so quite often the process to keep their infrastructure updated isn't as onerous as you see it in some larger enterprises. All right, the next story comes from Tripwire, and this is pretty interesting. They wrote a blog post that outlined 5 quick wins from the Verizon Data Breach Investigations Report. I thought it was worth recapping. Their quick win number 1 was address credentials, administrative privileges, and password hygiene. And their point was that 78% of the methods attackers used had either low or very low sophistication, and therefore focusing on access, credentials, privileges, and passwords are really where you're going to get the most bang for the buck. Their quick win number 2 was to protect key assets, and their point was that if you negate the ATM anomaly, that 2/3 of exfiltrated data came from databases and file servers. And so if you focus more attention around protecting those, you'll obviously see some benefit, because that's where the data is being exfiltrated from. Quick win number three was prepare for the most common attack types, which are physical, malware, and hacking. So things like disabling USB ports, or at least disabling auto run on USB drive insertion, and implementing strong system configuration and system integrity management file monitoring types of programs, or I would even say application whitelisting. Clearly, Tripwire being who they are interested in file integrity monitoring. And of course, in the context of this quick win, hacking is use of stolen credentials. So bolstering security around password strength, protecting against keyloggers, preventing password sharing, those sorts of things will pay dividends. Quick win number four is to detect and contain breaches early. Basically, if you can see that somebody's in your network before they have an ability to exfiltrate data or damage your systems, you can mitigate the intrusion. But what we see in the DBIR is that it takes many months, sometimes many years, for the average breach to be detected. And by that time, the damage has been done. Quick win number five is to choose and implement a security framework. And if you haven't read the DBIR, they recommend the SANS 20 critical security controls. There's lots of different frameworks out there. Point is, pick a framework and start wrapping it around your operations and use it to guide your strategy. I particularly like the SANS top 20 personally. I think it's a very good set of controls. It clearly isn't as comprehensive as some of the very long NIST standards, but it is pretty good and touches most of the points that people commonly need to worry about these days. All right, the next story was a recent blog post by some Google security researchers saying that Google is changing its stance and will allow 7 days from the time they notify a software vendor of an actively exploited vulnerability to the time that they will publicly disclose the vulnerability. So this is a very hotly contested thing in the security industry, particularly with software vendors. You know, they like to see basically things be kept under wraps until a patch is put out. This is slightly different than that full disclosure debate of, you know, a security researcher finds a vulnerability, he or she discloses the vulnerability to the manufacturer sits on it, and out of frustration, the researcher posts something, the full disclosure, to shame the manufacturer into action. This is a bit different because this is a specific case where Google is saying they are seeing active exploitation of this vulnerability. And their point is that, look, it's being exploited. So whether or not you have a patch for it is somewhat irrelevant. People really ought to know that there is a bug that is being exploited so they can take some action. Whether that action is to apply some mitigation based on guidance from the manufacturer, or uninstall the software, or block ports, or do something. But their point is that we just can't let this ride the way we have been in the past. So personally, I think it's a really good thing. I suspect it will continue to be the source of some consternation for a while, though. I will say most of the big software companies have come out in support of this. I know there is some grousing that this is Google thumbing their nose at Microsoft based on some recent things with Internet Explorer, but I'm not entirely sure that's true. I don't have any particular insight into the politics. I think this is really just a a pretty good, responsible idea. But for the security professionals, this is basically going to say we're probably going to be put in some difficult positions where we are being told that a piece of software we have pervasively throughout our environments is being actively exploited and there is no fix. So we've seen this in the past with particularly Java, and that causes lots of hand-wringing. I suspect that we're going to see a continuation of this based on this new practice. And it'll also be interesting to see if other researchers really start to embrace this kind of a concept too. And the final story comes from Dark Reading. It's from Wendy Nather, who is a very interesting lady to hear talk. She's got a great blog post here, and it basically talks about the importance of planning for the inevitability of your malware defenses failing. So what are you going to do when everything you've done to prevent a virus outbreak fails and you do get a virus outbreak? How are you going to, one, how are you going to know that it's actually happening? So this really talks about instrumenting your network and your systems so that you have an ability to see anomalies that indicate that you have some kind of an infection in your network. There's lots of different ways, lots of different technologies to do this. Many of them are complementary. I wouldn't, for instance, say monitor your DNS queries and not your NetFlow data. They are all part of an overall program. But for me, this makes a lot of sense. It's something that I'm becoming very interested in. It's a situation where I'm coming to realize how very difficult it is to actually prevent. And so we certainly need to keep our foot on the gas on the prevention front, but we also really need to now start thinking about the detection front. And this goes back to one of the quick wins that Tripwire cited in the article a couple articles back. We can't rely on antivirus. We know that. We can't rely on web filtering. We know that. We know that legitimate websites are becoming hosts of malware. We know that social engineering and phishing emails with viruses are becoming very, very sophisticated. We know that people are plugging in USB drives. We know all this stuff is happening. We do our darndest to mitigate bad things from happening through those vectors, but we have to be realistic and realize that they're going to fail some percentage of the time. So we've got to have some backstop to detect when that's failed. So Wendy gives some good thoughts on how to do that. This is not a simple topic. There's an entire PhD thesis worth of work here, and I certainly can't do it justice in a couple minute podcast. You know, one of the books that is about to come out from Richard Baitlick actually, I believe, is very much centered on this topic. That's the network security monitoring book that's coming out, I think, in July. The SANS group has a number of diary posts about monitoring DNS, and there's quite a number of different resources on how to go about this. You know, there isn't a silver bullet, as with everything else. It really comes down to assembling the right kind of infrastructure based on your environment and, of course, your risk tolerance and your ability to fund and operate such an infrastructure. All right, well, that is all for this week. I hope everybody has a great week. I know I am hoping for the best. I will probably be digging out from a week off of work, so I do plan on having a podcast next week. As usual, if you have any comments, questions, feedback, hate mail, don't like what I'm talking about, disagree, whatever, send me an email, info@defensivesecurity.org. Send me a tweet on Twitter, @DefensiveSec. You can find the show notes on the website, www.defensivesecurity.org. I have links to all the stories I talk about. Oh, one more thing. I thought this was pretty interesting. A little bit of errata. So when I was off last week, I was in Disney World. I stayed at a hotel in Disney World, and my website, defensivesecurity.org, was actually blocked by the Disney World web filter, and it was basically classified as pornography, and I, for the life of me, can't figure out why. So if anybody has any thoughts on why that might be, I'd be interested. They apparently are using a fairly old R3000 web filter. I think that is now owned by Trustwave, and I actually went to Trustwave's site and looked up my site, and they hadn't classified it yet, so the only thing I could figure is that there's some content on the site somewhere that is tripping their filter, so hopefully nobody else is running up against that. But anyhow, I appreciate everyone's time, and I look forward to talking to you again next week. Have a great week. Bye.